Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of consciousness, what that means, and who we are as a civilization. Where did we come from, and where are we going? And I don't think anyone is more qualified to take a stab at that question, take a real informed position about that topic than tonight's guest, Michael Cremo. He's called the Forbidden Archaeologist because what he's discovered is outside what's been acceptable in the formal archaeological circle. So, Michael, welcome to the program, and I'm excited about your work.
Good to be with you, Alan, and with all your listeners.
Yeah. So, thank you. Well, we can start anywhere, but I think, you know, what I would like to know from you is when that first moment, what was that first moment? So, you know, all of us are pretty much brought up in a mainstream culture, and we're taught certain ideas about civilization. And suddenly, you know, through your work and Len Graham Hancock's work, I suddenly realize it's not what we've been taught. But what was that moment for you? What was the discovery that said, hey, things are not what I was told?
Well, to really explain that, you have to know something about, you know, my background, how I was raised.
Okay.
My father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force. So that meant a couple things for me as I was growing up. One thing it meant is our family was moving to different places around the world. And that exposed me to a lot of different ideas and worldviews and cultures and things like that. So I came to understand there's more than one way to look at things. Because of my father's background in the intelligence services, I also came to understand there is such a thing as hidden knowledge. There are things about the world going on that many people just aren't aware of. And those things influenced me as I was growing up. And as I encountered different cultures, one of them was the spiritual culture of ancient India. Eventually, I became the disciple of a guru from India. And as part of that whole experience, I began studying the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And in them, I learned things completely different from anything that I had learned from my teachers in high school or university. One thing I learned is that these writings have accounts of a human presence on this planet going back millions of years, much further back in time than mainstream science allowed. So that was something shocking to me. And I began to wonder, well, how am I to look at these accounts found in these ancient writings, not just of the Indian culture, but actually many cultures around the world have the same idea. So I began to wonder, are they simply to be taken as mythology, or is there perhaps some factual basis for it all? So that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology to see if there actually were any reports of evidence of human bones, human artifacts, human footprints going back much further in time than.
But you found that. You actually are one of the few people that actually found the evidence. You found the anomalies. Can you talk about some of the things that were really shocking that you actually discover? I mean, it's great to have the philosophy and even the spiritual awareness, but to actually have the proof in your hands, that changes people's ideas and minds.
Yeah. Well, what I decided, you know, the first place I looked was in the current textbooks of archaeology and history. And I didn't find any evidence for extreme human antiquity there. But then I began wondering, okay, what if I looked beyond the textbooks? What if I started digging into the original scientific reports? What if I started doing that? What would I find? And I didn't know what I would find, but I simply had a suspicion that maybe something is there. So I started doing that. I started looking into the original scientific reports in archaeology from the 1860s, the 1870s, the 1880s, and so on. And I was really surprised to find there were many reports. For example, the California gold mine discoveries, I stumbled upon them. In the 19th century, miners went to California to get gold, and they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains like Table Mountain in the Sierra Nevada Mountains near Sonora. So deep inside the tunnels, the miners were finding human bones and human artifacts like obsidian spear points, stone mortars, and pestles in many different locations. And these came to the attention of Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. And he published a massive report about these discoveries, detailing exactly where they were found, what the geology of the locations were. It was a very detailed scientific report about hundreds of these discoveries. And it was published by Harvard University in the year 1880. And it was just shocking to me that there was this detailed scientific report that is totally absent from the modern textbooks. And I had to wonder why. Why is it? And I got an inkling of that when I encountered the work of William Holmes, who was a physical anthropologist working at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. He was a contemporary of Dr. Whitney's. And he wrote, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have come to those conclusions. He wouldn't have published that report. So it became clear to me that there was a knowledge filter operating in the world of science whereby discoveries that conform to the dominant theories become well known. They become integrated into the textbooks and the education system, whereas reports that radically contradict the dominant theories get filtered out. Now, ideally, that's not what should happen. What should happen ideally is that the theories should be modified in light of the facts. But what often happens is that the facts get modified in light of the theories.
Right. It's Thomas Kuhn's whole theory about paradigms, how people get attached, even when new evidence comes along that disproves it. They're emotionally attached to what they've invested in. And I think, I don't know who said that science progresses one funeral at a time. And it's too bad because, yes, what you think, new evidence comes along, you revise the theory. But that is not what seems to have happened throughout history. So we're coming to a new time now. I think there's, it starts on the fringes. I just saw Graham Hancock speak last week about his latest book, The Magician of the Gods, and Robert Schock, I saw a couple of, about 6 months ago, talking about this convergence of the Ice Age and the Flood, and definitely there are signs in Göbekli Tepe of a dominant civilization that is 10,000 or more years older. I mean, these things seem to be undisputable now. What the problem is, there's no theory to fit these findings in. So what would the theory that you would put out there about ancient civilizations that would help modify our understanding of history.
Well, as you're kind of hinting, it's a big task. But I think what it's all pointing to, if we look at all of the evidence, mm-hmm. is that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings. In one sense, a lot depends on understanding what a human being is. You know, before we start asking the question, where did human beings come from and how long have we been here and what is our real origin, we should first ask, what are we really? Mm-hmm. And today, mainstream science is giving extremely materialistic answers to these fundamental questions. Basically, they're telling us we're machines made of molecules, machines made of matter, in competition with each other for survival. And as far as our consciousness and minds are concerned, they would have us believe those things, mind and consciousness, are simply the results of molecules interacting in the brain. And when at the time of death the molecules cease to interact, then there's no more consciousness, there is no more mind, no more individuality, no personhood, nothing like that. So what they're basically saying is we're purely materialistic beings, but I don't accept that, and I think there's a lot of evidence accumulating on the fringes of science and within the scientific community itself showing that there is a conscious self that cannot be reduced to brain chemistry. There is a conscious self with its own existence, independent from the molecules in the brain, independent from the material elements that make up the body. And that conscious self has its origins in some higher level of reality that I would call the level of pure consciousness. And, you know, in different spiritual traditions, they might have different names to apply to that.
Well, but, I agree. I agree with it. And let's say that it's true. Let's say that. But let's talk about then civilization. So, yeah, we're these eternal, I'm not saying it lightly, but, you know, we're eternal divine beings. But let's talk about where that interacts in matter and the origins of civilization itself. Where do you see that? What's the history that is true for you about that, about the incarnation?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that some conscious selves cannot exist on that level of pure consciousness where the ruling principle is unselfish love for all other conscious beings and the source of all conscious beings. So when a conscious self becomes egotistical or selfish, there has to be a place where it can act out its desires, and that's the world of matter. And for the conscious selves that are on this level of reality, there can be two kinds of civilizations. One type of civilization is based on the idea that I am an eternal conscious self, an eternal being of pure consciousness. All other living things on this level of reality are beings of pure consciousness. We're all together in this. We all belong to the same family, and we should be trying to go back to the place where we're all originally from. Mm-hmm. And while we're here, we should organize our civilization so as to satisfy our material needs in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible while putting most of our human energy into cooperatively trying to raise the consciousness of each individual being on this level of reality up to its highest potential and its original source. So that's one kind of civilization, and such civilizations have existed since the beginning of time in the material world.
Let me just ask you for one second, do you then go along with the yuga system, the Hindu yuga system, that there was a golden age, silver, bronze, and now we're in the iron age, the densest?
Yes, I do.
The Kali Yuga. You do?
Absolutely, I do.
Okay. So we're according, I just spent 2 months with Robert Lawler, who wrote a book called The Geometry of the End of Time, where he talks about we're coming to the end of the Kali Yuga cycle. And, you know, he said we'll go into a time of darkness after, but we're coming, then we'll come back around to the golden age. And it seems like,
absolutely.
So it's not, in a way, our fault that we fell from the golden age. I mean, because it's a part of a natural cycle, right?
Well,
I mean,
just like, yeah, the seasons pass. Winter is coming on now in the temperate areas in the northern hemisphere. So, but just because it's going to become cold doesn't mean that you have to freeze to death.
Mm-hmm.
You can take actions that are going to keep you warm, and you can shelter others as well. So just because the seasons are changing doesn't mean that we have to be a prisoner of those changes.
So just because we're at the age,
even though they are there, and it makes things more difficult. Still, just because it's raining, it doesn't mean you have to get wet.
So just because we're in the age of materialism doesn't mean we have to be materialistic, is really what you're saying.
And the reason for that is because fundamentally, at the deepest level of our being, we aren't material beings.
Right.
And that's why we feel uncomfortable. If we really were just machines made of matter in vicious competition with each other for survival, then why would anybody care if some atrocity was committed somewhere in the world? Why would we feel threatened, or why would we feel angry, or why would we feel concerned, unless on some very deep level we understood that's not how things should be. That is not how things should be.
Right.
If on some fundamental level we weren't at our deepest level of consciousness aware of our existence as deathless beings of pure consciousness, why would we be upset about various atrocities that take place?
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. And do you think then it's the soul's journey to incarnate through certain levels of consciousness so we can gain awareness of creation? Is that, what's your idea?
Well, I think there's a choice confronting each conscious self on this level of reality. Mm-hmm. And that is, am I going to become more and more involved in thinking I am a machine made of molecules in competition with others for survival, and divide ourselves into competing, warring groups and overexploit the Earth's resources? Or am I going to be a conscious self that recognizes all others as beings of pure consciousness and tries to satisfy our material needs in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible while putting most of our human energy into developing that resource of consciousness and going back to the original home of the conscious self, what I call the level of pure consciousness, which is beyond all these cycles of time, like the yugas. There is a timeless level of reality that is beyond all of those kinds of changes. That's how I see it.
Well, but that we're the only, it's only the illusion that we're not there, in a sense. That's the sort of spiritual understanding I have.
Yeah.
We actually are there, but we've, you know, disconnected because of the Maya that the mind finds itself in, and the journey of awakening is to remember that we've never left that place.
That is something my guru once said. He said it's like you're lying on a bed. You may dream and be sleeping and dreaming that a tiger is coming to attack you, and you become afraid and frightened in the dream. But ultimately, you're somewhere else. And if you could wake up to that, you would understand it. But when the dream is going on, it's a very terrifying thing.
Well, yeah. So,
I agree with you. If we could wake up to that higher level of awareness, we'd realize there's nothing to be concerned about.
Right. And, of course, you know, we're also...
But when you're on that level of reality, you've got to deal with it.
Right. And that's what
we're... But the best way to deal with it is to wake up to the higher level of awareness, which is why the great wisdom traditions of the world all emphasize some kind of meditative or contemplative practice.
But I think within some actually ancient civilizations, there were structures and maybe even institutions, if you want to call it that, that activated that the whole, my idea is the whole reason for civilization and people living together was to remind ourselves of that greater awareness. Of course, now just the opposite. The whole idea of civilization is to distract us from that awareness. But I think...
Absolutely, I agree with you 100%. I think in the past there were civilizations that were organized along those lines. But now, you know, our worldwide human civilization is organized on another set of principles. And I think the role that the scientific community plays in all of this is enforcing a material sense of identity on the conscious selves that are now here, indoctrinating them the idea that you are just a machine made of molecules. That's what you really are. You are a product of purely material forces, and you're in competition with others for survival. That's the basic mindset of the modern worldwide human civilization today.
Right, but I want to know...
It's not organized on the proper principles. It could be organized in a different way, on a different set of understandings about who we are and where we came from. What if all of our scientists today were saying we're beings of pure consciousness, we're all part of the same family of pure consciousness, and we should all be working together, not dividing ourselves into competing groups, and we should be not trying to exploit the resources of this planet to the maximum extent, but to the minimum extent necessary to give people everywhere the material necessities of life in a fair way so that they can put most of their human energy into developing the resource of consciousness.
Right. I agree with that. But I want to also know what you know and what you've investigated. What were those great civilizations in the early days that didn't forget who they were, but came to play in the creation that they knew that they helped manifest? I mean, what is the physical evidence of the Satya Age, the Golden Age? I mean, do we have artifacts from those times?
Yes, there are artifacts from those times. If you investigate, you know, the cycles of the yugas, you'll see that the whole cycle of four yugas lasts, and this is according to the traditional understanding that's in the cosmological writings of ancient India, the Puranas,
yes,
they're called. A cycle of four yugas lasts for 4,320,000 years. And then there's another cycle, another cycle, another cycle, going back many, many millions of years. So in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, I documented archaeological evidence showing that humans indeed were existing during those times. The current idea in mainstream science is humans like us first appeared less than 200,000 years ago. And they would say before that time, there were no humans like us on this planet. There were simply various kinds of more primitive ape-like human ancestors. But even just this year, you know, there was an interesting discovery. Early this year, 2015, archaeologists in Africa at a place called Olduvai Gorge in the country of Tanzania. It's a very famous place. A lot of discoveries of Australopithecus and Homo habilis and other kinds of ape men were made at this Olduvai Gorge. But this year, and this is it may sound like a small thing, but it says something important about how science works. Archaeologists discovered the finger bone of some type of hominin in Olduvai Gorge in layers of rock 1,840,000 years old. So that would be from previous yuga. So they studied it very carefully, and they found it's different from any kind of finger bone of an ape or a monkey, from gorilla finger bones, from chimpanzee finger bones, from baboon finger bones. They also found it was different from any kind of ape man finger bone that had been studied, like finger bones of Australopithecus and Homo erectus and different kinds of ape men. They compared it to the finger bones of anatomically modern human beings, and they saw it fit exactly within the parameters of the measurements of what modern human finger bones are like. But in their scientific report, you know, the archaeologist said, but we can't call it human. We can't call it Homo sapiens because of the age of the formation in which it was found, 1,840,000 years old. So again, it just goes back to that idea that there's a process of knowledge filtration going on in the world of science. And you mentioned the work of Thomas Kuhn, who was the philosopher of science who popularized the concept of paradigm. In other words, scientists, they work under a certain paradigm, a certain set of ideas, and things that conform to the paradigm, they can understand and deal with. But things that are outside the paradigm that they're working with, they can't really recognize for what they really are. And, you know, there have been some interesting psychological experiments done with about, you know, just showing how difficult it is for people to understand and recognize anomalies. There was a famous experiment done with a pack of playing cards. You know, some psychologists prepared a pack of 52 playing cards, and in the pack, they included some anomalous cards. For example, a six of hearts with the six of hearts in black instead of red, and say a four of spades with the Four of Spades in red instead of black. So the way they would conduct the experiment was they would have a subject, a person, sitting down, and they'd show the person the cards from the deck, one after another, and ask them to identify the cards. And people just could not pick out the anomalies. Yeah, because we're just so used to seeing things in a certain way, even when something is right in front of your eyes that is definitely an anomaly, definitely
wrong. So if they saw a six of spades with the spade being red instead of black, they would probably call it a six of hearts or something like that, right?
Yeah, they just couldn't figure it out. They just couldn't recognize the things for what they are. So scientists operate the same way. Sometimes an anomaly can be staring them right in the face, and they can't really understand or recognize it. So
because they're not.
Giving that example of.
No, I think that's a great example.
They found a finger bone. They studied it very carefully. They said it's human in shape, but they couldn't recognize it as human because, according to their theories, humans didn't exist 1,840,000 years ago, which would be in one of the previous yugas.
Yeah, but I get those. I come across that when I talked about people about UFOs. I think I saw you at the Contact in the Desert UFO conference, and I get that all the time when I say I've seen things, and it doesn't fit into people's worldviews, so it can exist because there's no place for them to put the ideas, which of course is why you've called your archaeology forbidden, because there's no room for it in the mainstream. It has to be forbidden.
Yeah, so. that's one sense in which I use the word forbidden. But in some cases, people actually try to forbid me, from speaking about these things.
But, you're just presenting the facts. That's what I get from you. It's not your problem or fault that it doesn't fit in with their time frame. When the facts, but again, people will deny the facts to, like you just said, with this finger. They're in total denial. So what solution do they come up with about this then, with this little finger? What does it mean for them?
Well, what happens is it's just easier to set something aside or dismiss it or ignore it or explain it away or leave it for further research than to adjust the theory. That's a lot of work. It's easier just to set the anomaly aside. What I found amazing is in the scientific report, they just said, well, it looks human, but we can't call it human because of the age of the formation at which it was found. And they just left it at that. It's just really amazing. And this knowledge filtering process, as I call it, it does operate in a lot of fields. You'd mentioned you saw me speaking at a Contact in the Desert event, which is a UFO-oriented event. And I was really surprised, that I would get invitations to speak at UFO conferences. Forbidden Archaeology, my book Forbidden Archaeology, came out in 1993. I began speaking at archaeology conferences and things like that. But I was really surprised I started getting invitations from UFO conferences to speak. I think, what's their interest in archaeology? But I could see that what the real interest was the process of knowledge filtration, because I was documenting how this process of knowledge filtration operated in the field of archaeology with very well-documented cases. So I think that the UFO researchers kind of appreciated that because it was something they were running up against in their field.
Absolutely.
The knowledge filtering process.
That's what's happening. I mean, you know, people see things, and there's no place to put them in their cosmology. So they have to do two things. They have to either deny it, one or two things. They have to deny it and deny their experience, or they have to go beyond their conditioning. I mean, the first person to really talk about this kind of conditioning that I read was Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he wrote The Crack in the Cosmic Egg. Did you ever read that book?
No, I didn't.
It's a great book about cultural conditioning, and really we're like a fish in water. The fish doesn't see that it's in the water, but all our concepts, that's why I call my show New Realities, is conditioned by the cultural framework in which we live in. So I'm interested in talking to people like you who are beyond the pale, beyond that confines, and you're not interested in keeping a false idea of what could be together, but you're exploring the edges, and that's really part of our evolution. This leading edge, tearing down the old ways of thinking, ourselves as human beings, but even thinking of ourselves as a sort of civilization that started, let's say, even, you know, 5,000 years ago or whatever it is, ridiculous numbers like that, and showing that there's a greater context for who we are and we have a greater history as well. So that's what's exciting about your work, Graham Hancock, John Anthony West. These are the great figures of a new emerging civilization that's showing us the real past. So if we go back to the ancient times of the golden age, the golden yuga, what's your vision of a civilization that lived along those principles, and where do you see signs of those, of that sort of civilization existing, maybe even a million years ago? Do you have any, maybe not evidence, but intuition, feeling, sense about that?
Well, I think they were dominated with a sense that they're part of a whole cosmic community of beings, not just limited to this Earth planet or to this level of reality that they're, I mean, you were talking about New Realities, or that's the name of your show, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
So that there's more than one level of reality. There's hidden worlds, you could say, and that we have a connection with them. And, you know, one thing that has struck me as I've traveled throughout India is that a lot of this stuff is not, you know, buried in the ground in terms of archaeological evidence. It's still there. I mean, there are temples and sacred places all over India that are commemorating events that took place millions and millions and millions of years ago. There's a whole different sense of time and history. And, for example, in South India, there's a temple complex called Sri Rangam. And in this temple complex, there's a stone image of one of the Hindu deities, Vishnu, lying on a serpent bed. And if you inquire about the temple history, you'll be told that this sacred image has a long history that goes, first of all, off this planet. it was originally worshipped on some higher level of reality, and it descended to this planet millions of years ago and was worshipped successively by generations upon generations, right up to the present day, where it continues to be worshipped. So this object itself has a history that goes back hundreds of millions of years, according to the traditional understandings in history and histories. And on one of my recent trips to India, I stopped off in Cambodia to visit the Angkor Wat Temple on my way there. And the Angkor Wat Temple is known as the largest Vishnu temple in the world, even though it's outside the present boundaries of India. It's a United Nations World Heritage Site now. But if you carefully study the place, and Graham Hancock has been there, other researchers have been there, you'll find, now in terms of the civilization, the cosmology and astronomy and the time cycles of the yugas, it's all built into this, the architecture of this magnificent temple complex. You know, for example, if you carefully measure different structures in this temple, you'll find they encode the yuga cycles. For example, the Kali Yuga, according to the Puranas, is 432,000 years long. So as you enter the Angkor Wat Temple, there's a stone bridge that crosses a moat. And if you measure the length of this bridge, you'll find it's 432 cubits long, which is a reference to the Kali Yuga. And then there's another walkway that leads from the end of this bridge up to the first wall of the central temple complex, and it's 864 cubits long, which represents the age of a Dwapara Yuga, the previous Yuga, which is 864,000 years long. And then there's another measurement of the temple complex that is the length that refers to the length of the previous Yuga, and then another one that refers to the next Yuga. So all this is, all this cosmology is built right into the temple structure. So I think these ancient civilizations, if you look at their architecture and their artwork and their drama and their music, you find a lot of the cosmology and the higher knowledge is built right into those structures, which is fascinating because it's all meant to facilitate the elevation of consciousness.
Right. And yeah, thank you for that outline, because I even the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, I mean, reading...
Yeah, you can't be helped but be moved by those pyramids and the Sphinx and all of that.
But, you know, listening to Graham Hancock's latest lecture, he says that we're coming back around to this time. I mean, he's not the only one who says, but we're in this time of... but elevation. I mean, I don't know if Graham really said it, but he says, you know, coming back to the age of Aquarius and balancing the age of Leo, which was the sort of the end of the last age. I mean, the yugas and the precession of the equinox sort of line up. That's in Robert Lawler's book, The Geometry of the End of Time. He lines that up. But as we come back around, or as we kind of bring this awareness to more people, I feel we're in a shift. I mean, I think more people are remembering their divine nature. We're in the middle of a paradigm shift, a transition in civilization. Do you get that too?
Well, yes. In the spiritual line that I have associated myself with, there's an esoteric understanding that there can be a golden age within the Kali Yuga. And
right, it's a fractal. within the big A, those bigger ages, there are cycles, smaller cycles, yes.
Right. So that there, even though we're in the Kali Yuga at this point, according to a certain understanding, that within that Kali Yuga, there can be a golden age, just sort of like sometimes when winter is coming on, you get some warm days. Mm-hmm. So I think we're in a period like that right now. Although the general trend around us is one of increasing social and environmental degradation, and I don't have to give examples. Everybody.
But there's also more awareness. There's more people. Yeah, there's more. But there's the counterbalance to that, too.
That's
more
right. You're absolutely right. Even though the general trend is going in a direction, there's a counter trend that counter trend can bring in more and more and more people so that it just completely overwhelms the otherwise dark tendency of the age.
I mean, I think on the whole, though, we're becoming more aware. I mean, in general, people are even more aware of Eastern traditions and, yoga everywhere, massage.
Those
are
all positive signs. Increasing the numbers of people become vegetarians and vegans and, yeah, I think there are a lot of positive signs, definitely.
So do you feel we're in this upliftment? I mean, in this golden age? And so where do you see it going? I mean, let's say we do take, your research and many others and archaeology changes its mind and say, human beings did exist. Millions of years ago.
Well, the significance of that is we need new understandings of human origins. It's not just a question of how long we've been here, but it means we need a different understanding than the one we're getting now from science. And I think that
the Darwinian one, where we evolved from apes, is that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's we're central. We need some different understanding that is going to involve some kind of higher spiritual principles of consciousness.
Well, do you go along with the Anunnaki theory where we were modified by this superior alien race to, what's your feeling about that idea?
Well, I have kind of an expanded conception of what extraterrestrials mean. I mean, one version of that is that things went on pretty much as modern science says, primitive apes and monkeys turning into ape men, going up to about 300,000 or 400,000 years ago when you have the ape man known as Homo erectus. And at that point, there was some kind of extraterrestrial intervention that turned them into human beings. And I mean, that's one idea. But as far as I can see, there's evidence that humans like us have existed on Earth for millions and millions and millions of years, going right back to the beginnings of the history of life on Earth. So I think it's at that time that higher extraterrestrial beings put human bodies on Earth to be vehicles for conscious selves on this level of reality. So,
well, that means we
commonalities. I would have some,
but that does also mean
extraterrestrial beings, that we've been here a long time, but there might be some differences, but try to focus on what I have in common with people rather than what differences I might have with them.
No, but even if we were placed here by millions of years ago, that means we did evolve on some planet to get to this form, or did we just kind of incarnate in the reflection of the divine? You know, that's the other theory.
I'm more in favor of that the conscious selves who have chosen not to exist in the harmonious, loving cooperation of the realm of pure consciousness, a whole variety of bodily vehicles on the level of matter has always been available to them. And right. among those vehicles is the human vehicle. So I think that the whole range of plant, animal, human vehicles has always been available to conscious selves who descend to this level of reality according to their desire and level of awareness.
Mm. But the only thing I would add to that is that evolution exists as the divine amplifying its own creation. That's how I
would
explain
that. That's a good way to look at it. Another yeah. way is to understand that there can be this requires some understanding of the concept of reincarnation or the transmigration of uh-huh. the conscious self from one form to another. There can be an evolution of the conscious self through different bodily forms and experiences until it again reaches the level of total divine awareness. Mm-hmm. So there can be an evolution of consciousness through the different bodily forms, from the amoeba form up to the fish form, up to the amphibian form, to the reptile form, to the mammalian form, to the ape and monkey form, to the ape-men form, to the human form. So there can be an evolution of the conscious self through all these different experiential realities.
Right. But that would also go along with the whole idea about what's that biological concept where theology recapitulates, you know, how the development
ontogeny
of... Yes.
Phylogeny.
Which I would take that to the higher spiritual realms, that if we're evolving individually that way as incarnational beings, the whole civilization is also evolving that way, awakening to its own greater divine aspect. You know,
we're not in this just as individuals. We associate with each other in terms of societies, families, societies, cultures, nations, other groupings.
Other civilizations, other planets. I think that's where I get to. We're in a huge shift to that awakening. And that's why I think UFOs are and ETs are important, because obviously where consciousness is not just a local phenomena to planet Earth. It must exist throughout the cosmos. I mean, that's just as absurd as a Darwinian theory, thinking that, you know, inorganic matter was sparked by some accident.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, there are millions of cosmoses. Yeah, it's one of the features of Indian cosmology. You know, there's the Mahavishnu lying on the causal ocean, and when he breathes out, millions of universes come out from his form. And when he breathes in, millions of universes come in. And in each universe, there's life. Human life, plant life, animal life. So there are millions and millions of universes. So it's more of a consciousness-based picture of reality rather than a matter-based picture, as far as I'm concerned. So I think there are millions and millions of universes full of life, and we're just in one of them.
But do you think that it's true, in each of those universes, the nature or the sense of reality is different than this one? That's my feeling. It's like we cognize the world in a certain way, but in another universe, they might have different perceptions of.
Yeah, there's some indication of that in the. It's suggested in the cosmological writings. Uh-huh. Said when each of the universes emerges from the form of the Mahavishnu, there's a creator god who goes into each of these millions of universes, and he's called Brahma. And in the different universes, the one universe, the Brahma has four heads. In another universe, 100 heads. In another universe, 10 million heads. Because, as you were suggesting, in the different universes, things can be maybe even much more complex than we can even imagine.
Right. Right. I think it requires
a higher level of cognition, as you were putting it, to deal with the realities in those universes. So I would say, yeah, there can be different levels of cognition required in different universes.
And I think what's happening now is a blending of universes. I think we're amplifying cognitive awareness, and that's could be why there's such a backlash of fundamentalism, because that is too severe for people. But the people who are looking and on a path are realizing, this is just my theory, greater cognitive awareness that is actually moving them to a merging of universes. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, they're all going to come back to the same place.
Because when
the breath of the Mahavishnu goes out, all the universes come out and souls are injected into all of them. And then when the Mahavishnu breathes in again, they all come back into the same place. You know, it's so, yeah, I think there is a case that could be made for the cognizance of the different universes coming together.
Well, I just see more evidence of people waking up. I mean, truly awakening, like you know, the...
And a show like yours is helping that.
Well, thank you. But I also see people just on their own, without knowing anything about spirituality, having these spontaneous awakenings where suddenly they're seeing auras and they're accessing mantras and they're, you know, they're in a higher state through nothing that they've ever wanted to do. I have a video called Awakening Kundalini on my YouTube channel with these two party girls. They're in their early 30s and boom, overnight, they just like had this clarity of consciousness and their lives totally changed. And that happened to them out of nowhere. And I see
that. That does. Things like that do happen.
But it's happening more and more. It's happening.
That's good.
Yeah, no, really it is. And this is a movement. And so I think that movement is transforming the very culture we're living in. That's what I'm seeing from my point of view here. So, but what is your work taking you? Like, you know, as we kind of wrap up here, where's your work going? What's your latest theories and... Yeah, what's happening in your latest research?
Well, you know, I've got layers and layers of research that I'm engaged in. One thing I'm working on now is a book called More Forbidden Archaeology, because since the first book was published, more cases have come to my attention. So I've learned some new things about some of the cases I included in the original book. So that's going on. And then I'm involved in a project that's called the Temple of Vedic Planetarium, which is being erected in India over the next few years. And I'm part of a group that's going to be helping with exhibits and planetarium shows for that project, and hopefully we're going to be incorporating a lot of the kinds of ideas that we've been talking about. And, you know, it's just endless.
But I'm just interested in that new book that you have, expanding upon the original Forbidden Archaeology stories. Like, which ones are you expanding upon from that original book that you wrote?
Well, I'm adding some new cases that have come to my attention, and then
can you go into that a little bit? Just some of those cases,
some of the new cases. Well, for example, in 2013, archaeologists discovered dozens of footprints on the coast of England at a place called Happysburg. I may not be pronouncing it properly, but that's how I pronounce it, Happysburg. And, you know, they measured the footprints very carefully, and they found they were exactly like those of populations of living humans. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, Native American Indians, Eskimos, things like that. So, people like that. So, the problem for them was that these were found in sediments about 1 million years old. And according to their theories, humans like us didn't exist, mm-hmm. you know, millions of years ago. Right. That's a forbidden idea. So they just decided, well, they must have been made by some kind of ape man who lived in Europe 1 million years ago. So it's just another example of evidence for extreme human antiquity staring scientists in the face. You know, they find these footprints, they measure them, they find they're exactly like modern human footprints, but they cannot bring themselves to admit this is evidence that humans like us were existing 1 million years ago. So that's, you know, one of the cases. Also, from the earlier history of archaeology, some new cases have come to my attention from the country of Argentina, where in 1921, for example, an Argentine archaeologist named Dr. Vignati found a fragment of jawbone with two molar teeth in it at a place called Miramar, which is a little bit south of Buenos Aires on the Atlantic coast of Argentina. So they were found in layers of rock that belong to what's called the Chapadmalolan Formation, which according to modern geologists is between 3 and 4 million years old. Now the jawbone and the teeth were studied by other archaeologists and anthropologists, including some from America, and they concluded they were just like those of anatomically modern human beings. So again, it's another case of evidence showing that humans like us were existing millions of years ago. So those are, you know, some of the cases I'm currently researching, you know, for inclusion in this new book of mine, which I'm calling More Forbidden Archaeology.
Right. No, thank you for all that. I mean, how massive was that ancient civilization 1 million years ago? Was it global, pretty much, and was it all connected?
Well, there were at different periods of time, mm-hmm. people were living in different ways.
I see.
You know, in the earlier times, in the Golden Age, the golden age of Satya Yuga, most people, they weren't divided into different social classes. Everyone was kind of like a yogi or a meditator or something like that, and they were living very simply in harmony with nature. And then in the next stage, things, you know, they started dividing themselves into social classes, where you have some people that are more, there's still some very spiritual people, yogis and meditators and people like that. But then there's some people that are kind of a little controlling. You know, they want to organize things, but they're still good people. Yeah, you know, they're not into exploiting or dominating or controlling in a selfish way, but they have a tendency to try to organize things. And then there's some people, they're mainly inclined into producing wealth and engaging in agriculture, and then there are other people who are more like artisans and workers and artists and people like that. So they start developing villages and towns. Those tendencies kind of increase in the next stage. You get highly developed civilizations with extensive trade and commerce and architecture and military organizations and government organizations, and they start getting a little bit competitive with each other and engaging in fighting and things like that. But still a little bit of ethics and morality involved in there somewhere. And then in this age, the age that we're living in now, things get very degraded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of warfare that we see and the kind of violence just gets really crazy.
Yeah. Well,
so I would say about 1 million years ago, there would have been developed cities and civilizations in all parts of the world. They may have been in communication with each other, and they were also in communication with extraterrestrial levels of reality as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they may have been in conflict with each other, you know, at times, but there was a kind of civilized code of warfare going on. So that's the kind of thing I think would have been going on about 1 million years ago.
Have you been looking at any of the archaeological evidence on Mars, some of the artifacts that seem to be every once in a while appearing of a woman standing or some pyramid shape or some animal art?
Yeah.
Have you looked at any of that? What do you make of that?
I'm aware of these things. Yeah, alternative archaeology and alternative history is a big field. You know, there are lots of different researchers concentrating in different areas. Yeah, you know, I've been kind of focusing on the extreme antiquity of the human species on this planet.
Right.
But there are others. And, you know, one thing I found very interesting is, you know, I speak in a lot of different venues. I speak on a radio show like this, for example, and sometimes I speak at universities, and sometimes I speak at scientific conferences. You know, I speak at archaeology conferences, meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, for example. And one interesting thing I found is that at these meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, some archaeologists have been speaking about extraterrestrial archaeology.
What is
that? One thing they've been talking about is what they're going to do with all the stuff that we've sent up there.
Uh-huh.
You know, like we've sent probes to the moon and Mars and Venus. And one thing they're discussing is, well, when archaeologists go up there and they find, you know, the stuff left over from the Apollo missions or the Russian missions.
Right.
You know, whose museum are they going to go into and like that? But they're also starting to wonder, professional archaeologists, what if we find things that we didn't send up there? So even in the professional scientific circles, they're starting to talk about things like this. As far as I'm concerned, is all these celestial bodies are inhabited or have been inhabited, and therefore, you know, it wouldn't be surprising at all from my point of view to find archaeological evidence on the moon or Mars. I haven't stayed up on all the details. I mean, other researchers are focusing on those things, but it's any theoretical objection to any of that.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting. Every once in a while, the rover or the whatever they call that little thing that's crawling around the Martians.
People have sent me pictures of
I mean, it's obvious to me that there was a civilization. There may still be a civilization on Mars. I think there are canals there or underground tunnels where it seems like a civilization, as one psychic said, the more developed civilizations live in the interior of the planet because it's safer there, you know? It's safer from meteors and comets, so that could be where the Martians are inside of Mars. I mean, there's the whole hollow planet theory, and you know, I tend to believe that there's some truth in all that. So, no, it's just interesting that, you know, we have a long way to go intellectually to just accept that your evidence is true, and then, you know, transfer that to other worlds and accept life there. But I think it's happening. I think it's coming. I think it's going on. So thank you for all your work. Any final words? Any?
Well, my latest book,
yes,
if people are interested, it's called My Science, My Religion. And it's a collection of 24 papers that I presented on these topics at mainstream scientific conferences, which is, I mean, some people are a little bit surprised that I'm able to do that, that I'm able to say these kinds of things in those circles. So if any of the readers or any of the listeners are interested to see exactly how I present this forbidden archaeology and the lied topics in scientific circles, they may want to have a look at that book, My Science, My Religion. Mm. And if they do get a copy of that book, they'll also receive a free copy of Bhagavad Gita, which is one of ancient Indians' most well-known spiritual texts, if they get the book from my website, mcremo.com.
Right. Are you recognized by other archaeologists, or are you sort of, I mean, you're not an archaeologist, I mean, as far as...
No, I'm not a PhD-trained archaeologist. I think my field is more like history of archaeology. Mm. But I've regularly been able to present papers on my work at mainstream archaeology conferences, and some of those papers have been published in peer-reviewed scientific volumes and magazines. Mm. That are published by these archaeologists. So, so I think it's interesting. There is, it could be another one of these signs of awakening that you were talking about, that even within these professional circles, although there's certainly a whole lot of scientists who disagree with what I say and don't like hearing about it and would rather not hear me, that there are some who have minds that are open enough that they're willing to listen to alternative ideas. So that's one aspect of my... I try to reach a lot of different audiences, mm-hmm. because I think in this negotiation of our new reality... as we might call it, there are a lot of different parties to the negotiation, and I think among them are some mainstream scientists, also alternative researchers, also people with just a general interest in things. So I think there are a lot of different parties to this whole negotiation of our new concept of reality. And I try to stay in touch with all of them and not just be boxed into speaking to just one segment of all the potential groups that are interested in these things.
Well, I think it's really an exciting time we're in right now because people are open to these new ideas and this new integration. And I think, you know, you keep doing what you're doing and shaking up the mainstream. It's gonna have an effect. It's gonna have an awakening. That some of your proof is undeniable that they'll have to revise their theories, and when they revise their theories, they'll have to revise everything we think we are, like you said in the beginning of the show. So that's why I feel we're really in an exciting shift of awareness. So thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
And maybe I'll see you at a conference somewhere next summer coming up.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, I've been trying to focus a little bit on my writing, but maybe by that time I'll be going out to the conferences again.
Did you ever read Gene Gebser's Ever Present Origin?
There's so many things I haven't read. That has to be one of them.
That is a brilliant, brilliant book. And of course, like I mentioned earlier, Robert Lawler's, Robert Lawler, right?
I've heard the name. I don't think I've ever met him personally.
He's a brilliant guy. He wrote the first book on sacred geometry for Thames.
Maybe I did meet him once in England.
But his latest book, The Geometry of the End of Time, talks all about the yuga systems and the Puranas and the sacred geometries embedded in those numbers as it lines up with the precession of the equinox. It's really brilliant. You might enjoy that. It's just out now. I just did a whole study with him. So I think that might add
Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, it's called The Geometry of the End of Time, and you can order it, I guess, on Amazon. It's really well written, and it fits very much in alignment with what you're saying. So, thank you. And your website, again, is mcremo?
Yes, mcremo.com, mcremo.com.
Yeah, no, I really enjoy your work. You're revolutionary. You stand by what is obviously true, and I think it's really important to stand up to the mainstream that always thinks it has the answers or always likes to put on the show that they know where all these pieces fit, and yet they leave out a whole body of knowledge that it's like the church. Let's just throw books out of the Bible that don't fit with the doctrine. It's scientism, as Charles Fort said back in the early 1900s. You know, it's the religion of science that we've been taken into, and it's important that we have alternatives. So here we go. Thanks again, Michael.
Okay, thank you, Alan.
I enjoyed it. And when your next book comes out, let's do it again, okay?
That sounds great.
And we'll do a video interview next time, too. You're in California, aren't you, somewhere?
Yes, I am.
All right, so when I'm out there next time, I'll let you know, and we'll do a sit-down video interview for my YouTube channel.
Okay,
so I've been talking to Michael Cremo, the author of Forbidden Archaeology, a whole bunch of, let me see, I have a whole list of your books here. Let me just tell people what else you've, what do you want to just name your other books there? I'll name them. anyway, you can look at M. Cremo, Forbidden Archaeology. He also has a website, Human De-Evolution. Amazing material that definitely proves the fact that we are not just who we've been told you are, but we have a greater history, as Michael said. So you can look at his website, M. Cremo, C-R-E-M-O. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening.